Good afternoon.
It does work. We have a session about to begin here. Thank you for coming this afternoon. Before I begin, I have just noticed, perhaps I'm the last one to notice, but I've just noticed that the conference is being tweeted. So if any of you have your Twitter strapped to you, hashtag ARSC2012, and you'll find a running commentary, sometimes complimentary, sometimes not, about the sessions going on right now, which may be a first for ARSC, I'm not sure. Not the sometimes yes, sometimes no, but the technology at least. We have three speakers today. I'll get right to them because I'd like to hopefully leave enough time for some Q&A at the end. The questions will be after the all three presentations are concluded, so please have your questions ready when we conclude. Our first speaker is Robert J. Heber, who is the Vice President of Audio Deluxe Media Services at the Chase, and I hope I'm pronouncing things correctly here, Audio. He's been working in film sound preservation and restoration since 1990 when he joined Chase Audio. Is it Chase Audio?
Yes, Chase.
Chase is pronounced. He's a member of EMEA. Got that right. SMPTE, ARSC, and the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. He served on three national panels for the Library of Congress and has spoken on film sound preservation, restoration, and remastering at conferences around the world. Prior to joining Chase, Bob was studio manager for Warner Brothers and an award-winning 16mm filmmaker in Chicago, Illinois. Chase Audio is a well-known sound preservation company located in Burbank, California, beautiful downtown Burbank, presumably. The company projects include Gone with the Wind, Patton, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and West Side Story. Robert Heber.
Thank you, Tim. Good to be with you again this afternoon. It's actually Heber, but I've gone through my whole life that way, so not to worry. I want to thank you again for coming back and getting another round of bad jokes because, I can't resist. This is a really interesting story, and it begins, it's one of those really great archive stories because it begins with a lonely can of film sitting on a shelf, neglected for practically 90 years before somebody picked it up and said, gee, what's inside of this? And so I'm very happy I can come here and share that with you today. And we've all heard of the key contributors of the development of motion picture sound. We're talking about guys like Theodore Case, who just lived right down the road here in Auburn, New York, and his partner Earl Sponable, E.C. Wente, Peterson and Paulson, Eugene Lost, the team at Tri-Aragon. So the question is, who was Sven Berglund, and how does he fit into this story? Well, here's how we'll tell you. This is my contact information. If you need to reach out to me, please send me an email. Always glad to answer questions or do any other kind of collaboration. So here's how we'll cover it. We'll talk a little bit about Sven Berglund, and we'll find out about him. And, so who was Sven Berglund, and why does anybody care about him besides his mother? We'll talk about acoustical optical recording. And, of course, it's kind of great in this environment. Acoustical recording is not a new topic for anybody sitting in this audience. We'll talk about how we went about recovering the sound, what the institute, which was the Swedish Film Institute, where this reel of film was repatriated to, what their plans were for preservation, and as Tim said, we'll hold the questions and answers until the end of the presentation. So this is really, it's really going to be sort of a smorgasbord of ideas, but as your cultural ambassador to Sweden today, there's the proper spelling for smorgasbord, and it's not the buffet that we recognize when we go to restaurants and we have all these things. Traditionally, a true smorgasbord up in the Scandinavian countries is just a selection of meats and cheeses that you put onto a very dense, hard bread. Of course, there's a lot of herring, and you make small open face sandwiches. So there's your cultural lesson for this morning. Let's talk a little bit about Sven Berglund. Oftentimes, if you look in any literature, you'll see that this is how his name is listed, and that's because the Scandinavian convention, the sons take on the name of their father, and in this case, Sven's dad was Arcadius, so he became Arcadius' son, hence Sven A. Son Berglund. We'll, of course, just refer to him as Sven. His dad was actually a military man and was in the engineering corps and probably most notably authored a book of worldwide inventions. So it's not unusual then to see that Sven goes into a technical engineering career. And he went, in fact, to the University of Berlin-Charlottenburg in 1901 to study engineering at the age of 20. By 1906, this might look interesting, he was already experimenting with recording sound waves onto photographic plates. So in a sense, he was sort of developing either a photographic version of gramophone, or if he had only known, he would have invented the CD. Of course, we understand that really recording sound waves, David Giovannani is here, and the work that he's done with Eugene Scott de Martinville in the very early recordings of sound waves using carbon plates and carbon paper really goes back to the early 1850s. So, but he understood the acoustical properties of gramophone and wax cylinder recording, which, of course, we know date back to the 1880s. So these recordings, by the way, were actually recovered by the Royal Institute of Technology with a scanning system not unlike that Carl Haber developed up at the Livermore Laboratory. And I think you can actually find a little bit of this online, what these sounded like. So, you know, as I say, you know, talking about acoustical recording to this audience is a little bit of going, we can go through this pretty quickly because I think everybody here is very much familiar with this. When I spoke to our film conference people, for them, understanding the differences in acoustical recording was a little bit of an educational process. But Berglund understood early on one of the fundamental weaknesses of acoustical recording was, of course, the amount of energy needed to cut a groove into the wax cylinders, okay? So, you know, you see here, of course, the cutting stylus attached directly to the membrane. So he went about this using a photographic method because he realized that he could actually attach a mirror to the membrane and modulate light, and so it would require much less inertia, be much more sensitive to sounds because he wouldn't have to be digging these grooves into soft wax. Here's actually an example of one of his machines from 1911, and at this point he was working at Gerdsen in Germany, who was a projector and lens manufacturer, and so this was really sort of his introduction into motion pictures. Now, we also know that as early as 1902, if any of you were here yesterday, you know Leon Gaumont and Oscar Mester were already working to try to bring sound into motion pictures. So this is something that is, of course, really on people's mind almost from the beginning when motion pictures are being exhibited. This is a shot of the Lieben tubes, or the Lieb tube developed by Robert von Lieben. What I found very interesting in looking at this development, and we see this a lot during this period of time, is the kind of parallel development that's happening in the United States technologically and what's happening in Europe. So Robert von Lieben develops these tubes in 1906. You know, you have Lee DeForest developing the Audion tube at approximately the same time. Obviously, you know, the opportunity to share information, you know, across a vast ocean wasn't as facile as it is today. So you have lots of parallel development of technology. So at this time, he formed the very first of his venture companies to help develop sound for motion pictures. And just like the work that was happening in the United States, the plan was we develop a technology, we control it, we control the patents, and we own the technology in the motion picture industry, which, of course, as we know, motion picture patent office and things like that, this was what it was all about. It was about really controlling the economics of the industry. So at Gerdsen, he began his work into optical sound, and he started working with 35-millimeter film, and it was a continuous piece of film, so in essence, just a piece of film without perforations. And he grabbed a group of investors, and they called the company Photo Aerophone, which isn't too dissimilar from what RCA eventually developed as Photophone in the late 1920s. Well, sadly, World War II intervened, And where everybody thought this would be a very short-lived affair, we all know that it dragged on for years. And so he made actually a very daring trip back to Germany during the war and picked up all of his equipment from the laboratory and spirited it back to Stockholm where he could continue his experiments. And there is Sven in his laboratory in Brevik, just outside of Scotland, outside of Stockholm. He had really one very prescient statement here in his writings where he said, an inventor devotes at least as much time to raise money for his research as he spends on doing his research work. So I don't think that has changed all that much in the years that have passed. This was his studio in Brevik, near Stockholm, kind of has a big black box kind of studio. And in February 17th of 1921, he demonstrated his synchronized sound system for motion pictures. And he used electrical amplification for playback, but he was still recording his sound acoustically onto the film. And there were a number of press reports and coverage. It was quite an amazing technical demonstration. King Gustav V of Sweden attended the demonstration. And the reports were all very positive about the synchronized quality of the material and the intelligibility of the speech. And in fact, there were certain comments that stated that it sounded actually better than some of the phonograph recording quality of the time. Interesting, because it's actually the very same kind of technology as far as a method of capture. And he had some speeches and a famous actress. And with this, it was really the culmination of 12 years of hard work. And he gained new investors to look at this, but not unsurprisingly at the same time, there were numerous reports about the aesthetics of adding sound to motion pictures and how it would ruin the art form. And as we know, when sound did come into motion pictures, really kind of motion pictures as art takes a big step backwards because of the limitations of recording sound on the set and what they had to do with the cameras. So he actually had an opportunity to meet Léon Gaumont, who was a very famous French producer and inventor. But Berglund's investors didn't want him to meet it because they were afraid he was going to steal his idea and steal basically the technology and take it back to France for his own, where we do know that Gaumont developed his own double system kind of film sound process. Well, Sven goes back to Germany after these demonstrations, and he goes to work for the Ernemann Company, and he founded Film Photophone, so another version of his company as he's working to continue to develop his technology. But the hyperinflation in Germany after World War II made this not a viable business opportunity. Ernemann, by the way, ended up merging with Carl Zeiss, the lens manufacturer, in 1926. He probably realized also at about this time that electrical recording methods, which are being introduced and was now much more widely available, was really superior to his acoustical sound recording technology. And so his process was abandoned. Also at this time, we have the work of Tri-Aragon in Germany. They start in 1922, and by this point, they've already demonstrated a single system sound system. And so it's quite likely that the fact that Berglund got such a good head start, he started in with an acoustical method, but sadly, the time it took him to develop electrical recording technology comes available and actually makes his system just not as complete. And while he could have incorporated electrical recording technology, because he was developing a double system technology where he had a sound recorder for the soundtrack, and then of course the motion picture camera recording the image, made this also a more difficult kind of technology to implement in the motion picture world. This is a little example of the Tri-Aragon guys on the set here in 23 and what their soundtrack looked like on the film. So here is Berglund standing next to the camera. The dapper guy in the center is actually important to our story. This is Wolfgang Filsinger, who was one of his assistants. And he's really the guy who's kind of responsible for this because he collected both the experimental films and wrote a number of papers about his work with Berglund. And it's really sort of Filsinger's archive that allows us to know really about the work of Sven Berglund. Sven was awarded an honorary doctorate in 1936 from the Technical University of the Berlin and Charlottenburg. He continued doing some other work. He worked on film sound synchronization methods for post-production, even worked on an early version of 3D photography. And sadly, at the age of 56 in 1939, he died in Berlin. But as I say, Filzinger was the guy who collected up all this material, and he created the Filzinger Archive. And this is the actual piece of film that was discovered, as you can see, in June of 2009 at the Deutsches Film Institute. And as I say, it was this lonely can sitting on a shelf that had been neglected for all of these years. Filzinger's son actually was responsible for moving this material to the archive. And in fact, not unlike many collectors, he sold it to them as a way of trying to gain some money out of his dad's work. This reel was actually discovered June 26th, and it's a reel of sound experiments edited together, and sadly, there's no corresponding picture for the experiments. If you remember, it was double system, one camera for the picture and one camera for the sound. There were also some other material donated to the Swedish Film Archive, and unfortunately, no work was done on it, and by 1997, being on nitrate film, it was no longer retrievable due to nitrate decomposition. So let's talk a little bit about acoustical recording, but very briefly, because you guys are a lot smarter about it than I am. Well, here's a pretty famous kind of ethnographic recording, but of course, as we know, you're going to shout down the horn in order to be able to get the cutting stylus to go. Here are some nice examples of how the cutting stylus and the different methods for recording acoustically work. And of course, the idea is that you have to really gain a lot of energy to move that stylus into the soft wax or onto the disc in order to cut the groove. Well, here's a couple of Berglund's patent drawings showing that he's actually going to attach a mirror to the membrane in order to get it to vibrate. And he realized that, of course, some of this work about modulating sound with light really goes back to some of the work that Alexander Graham Bell had done in the 1880s. And again, I don't think it's unlikely, or probably is quite likely, that the fact that his dad collected this book of all of the inventions of the world, you know, contributes to the fact that he had this really wealth of knowledge, you might say, in his family history. But the idea that he could use much less kinetic energy to modulate sound and record it allowed him to create what he felt would be greater dynamic range and be able to record material from much further away, hence the idea of being able to use it on a motion picture set where you might have action across the room. In fact, he even he said that he could record sounds from perhaps 6 to 8 meters away from the funnel, which is, as you know, quite a big distance. Now, at this point, you really probably want to see what his system looked like. So here we are. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Mrs. Berglund's favorite recipe for Swedish meatballs. And I have to tell you that, you know, the real trick with eating Swedish meatballs is, of course, to have the lingonberry jam. And if you have an IKEA anywhere near you, you can get that for 99 cents a jar. And it's quite delicious. All right. Here's really what's Sven built, all right? So we can see that we have a large funnel that's going to capture the sound, and the membrane is mounted on this very heavy plinth to avoid any additional vibrations from interfering. Attached to the membrane was the mirror, which started to wiggle, and then it's going to pass through a lens and over a number of basically dividers to do it. This is actually the light shining over the dividers that's going to the mirror, which is wiggling right there. And then we're going to focus it up on a slit on the sound projector that is going to record it. And, we can see that it was very kind in these drawings that he could tell us that the film is traveling at 22 frames per second. So it wasn't quite at sound speed yet, but of course, very important for us to know what the correct speed was to do the transfers. So thank you very much, Sven, for your good documentation. So here we are, Sven, in his laboratory in 1919. And, you know, it's very important to have these technical drawings to secure the patents, and so this is why we have this great documentation. As I said, it was a double system, meaning one camera just to record the sound, and that would be the sound camera there on that big table. And you see he used the full width of the film for recording the sound. So he's using basically a recording area of 25 millimeters wide on a 35 millimeter piece of film. So the standard release print that we have today, of course, puts an optical soundtrack in 1/10 of an inch or 100 mils, okay? So the fact that, again, this was a double system sound, and even though it was could achieve perfect synchronization, it was a very cumbersome and expensive setup. Again, most likely why the system was certainly not pursued. Well, the real fun here is trying to recover the sound of these soundtracks. And here are a couple images. You can see that we had lots of different modulation, and I expect that he was experimenting with trying to find the best signal-to-noise ratio or the best size of the soundtrack that would be used to convey the sound. And so we actually have tracks from 1 to up to 27 striations of optical sound recording. Now, this isn't exactly new, because just down the street in Schenectady, New York, you have Charles Hoxie, who develops the Palo Photophone. What's different there, of course, is you notice he's using film as audio tape. There's no perforations. And he's actually able to record 11 different individual soundtracks. He's doing multi-track recording. It wasn't really multi-track, but he's doing multiple recordings of individual tracks.
It was continuous loop.
Was it continuous loop?
It's one recording that's an hour and a half long.
Is that what that was?
Yes.
I was told these were different recordings.
No.
So it's one long recording as if it was in a continuous loop.
Then it would move down and record the next.
Right.
Around.
Well, very good. But as we can see, putting multiple stripes of sound on one piece of film wasn't a new idea.
Right.
And same thing went with John Maurer of Massillon, Ohio, who developed the Maurer optical sound system, where he could have up to 10 tracks of modulation, but he squeezed it into the standard 100 mil area of the soundtrack. He did that both in 35 millimeter and a smaller amount in 16 millimeter. So again, this is the system that Berglund used to record sound acoustically. And let's talk a little bit about the recovery of the tracks. So, of course, the tracks are modulated, and he used an early photoelectric cell to play it back. So he's using electrical amplification for the playback of the sound. Well, as we can see, the standard soundtrack negative occupies this 100 mil area at the edge of the soundtrack, and conventional sound reproducers expect to find a soundtrack in that space. So there's no method right here to move that fixed position over to read Berglund's tracks. And in fact, he doesn't really record right out to the edge, which is where the modern conventional soundtrack lives. Well, at Chase, we have a specialty technology for recovering soundtrack negatives, and it has the capability of reading the push-pull soundtrack, which is 200 mils wide. And by reading it both in the standard 35 millimeter positions A and B wind, we can reach both sides of the track. And in 16 millimeter, we can actually move it and read the center of the track. So you can see that as a 200 mil read, we're able to get about 5.8 millimeters of this 25 millimeter track. And as we switch positions for 16 millimeter and then switch the wind, we're actually able to make three scans of this soundtrack to be able to see if one particular area or another had better signal to noise or better reproduction quality. So we captured all three of these scans digitally. We recorded them at 24 frames per second. I'll get to a second. But here was kind of one of the little things that was a surprise. These are some of the actual scans of the soundtracks that we picked up. And you can see it's almost like looking at Oscar Fissinger's work, where he was designing designs and soundtracks. There's some pretty interesting images that he recorded. But the film was put together both heads to tails and tails to heads, hence the title, Heads or Tails. And of course, we just assume that when these small bits were probably assembled at the Deutsches Film Institute archive, there was no way for them to really know which was forward running or which way was reverse running. For them, they were just 11 different pieces of film to be spliced together and build a reel. But obviously, when we start to play them back, we're going to be able to hear materials running backwards. As I said, we saw that the material is running at 22 frames per second. However, the client wanted a new soundtrack negative made, and optical recorders run at 24 frames per second, and very difficult to try to slow them down. That's a whole technical challenge in and of itself. But as we all know, and this is a look at what our transfer room looks like, is that if we transfer and record at the same speed, then we really haven't changed the speed of the recording at all. So if our playback is at 24 and our recording is at 24, it's still the film is still really running at its same native speed. We could transfer to 10 frames per second and record it at 10 frames per second. So knowing the fact that 1-to-1 is pretty simple math, is going to work, if we maintain that relationship, we'll have a capture that's accurate when the Swedish Film Institute, who has a variable speed projector, plays it back at 22 frames per second. So we did all of our work at 24 frames per second in order to make it consistent for our optical recorder, but we did audition the material digitally at 22 frames per second so we could hear what this material actually sounded like. It was very important to understand that for the processing that we were going to be asked to do. Well, of course, in digital audio workstations, very simple to flip the files and go from heads to tails and tails to heads again if we wanted to. But for really important historical material like this, after finding this discovery that half or about four pieces of the 11 were running backwards, we made the decision to make a second transfer from tails to heads so we could capture all of the material in the proper direction because, as we know, lots of discussion about the way attack and trail off works. And for, again, this important historical capture, there's no reason not to do the job right. I should also mention that while the original film was nitrate, we had a very good safety copy made at Nordisk Film in Sweden. So we were actually working with a print of the film on safety film. And this way we could do a lot of experimentation and not have to worry about damaging an important original artifact. Of course, we do this work in a digital audio workstation room. And so after the transfers were completed, our engineer evaluated all the tracks for best playback. We found that actually the B-wind position, so tracks towards the edge, had the best sound quality. All of them really sounded fairly similar, and it didn't really seem to make any sense to try to pile them up on one on top of another because of the signal-to-noise ratio issues. You get a little more signal, and you're going to get a lot more noise. So really, you know, we only used two tracks when we were making our modern opticals today. Didn't seem to be any real advantage to having all of those striations. We did, though, assemble all of the material into a forward running direction because the Swedish Film Institute wanted to have a demonstration film, and I don't think, even though we have a preservation copy of all of the material kind of running in both directions, you want to have to explain to somebody, well, half this material, you know, is running backwards, because it's pretty hard to understand even as we hear it. Well, the real question is then, how do you attack material that's recorded really before modern sound recording technologies have been kind of codified, and what's it really supposed to sound like? So we had to determine what our goal was with our clients as far as addressing what are really very poor signal-to-noise issues. Now, he claimed, as I said, that he could record speech from 8 to 10 meters away. And when you hear some of it, I don't think we'll doubt his claims, but I think we will probably all agree that no one would want to go to a motion picture and listen to that kind of a soundtrack. The level of intelligibility is quite compromised. And Filzinger noted in his notes that the laboratory in which they were working had electric trolleys that were going by that would actually cause the voltage to vary as they went down the street. There were vibration noises on the floor. The lice spat and hissed, and the batteries created a fine mist of fumes. We would probably say that this is not an OSHA-approved work environment. But it really wasn't about how good we could make the sound. It was really about addressing some of the really issues that you might say were kind of the results of the laboratory that he's working in, and then also try to preserve really what the Swedish Film Institute wanted as a very authentic sound. So one of the things that we had fortunately available to us now, again, is this improvement in restoration tools, which I talked a little bit about yesterday. And one of the new ones, of course, is this new process of noise demodulation. And as I mentioned again yesterday, it's really a counterintuitive process. This is a variable density soundtrack, and you see all these crazing lines. This causes lots of noise in the soundtrack, terrible fluctuating noise floor. Well, this tool works, as I say, counterintuitively. Normally, when we do our processing, we're looking to subtract problems from the track and improve clarity. But in order to smooth out this very fluctuating modulation of noise, the noise demodulation tool actually adds noise into the track, takes a sample of the noise floor, makes a calculation of a noise to add to kind of improve, kind of basically raise all of the noise floor, but then apply processing to reduce the noise floor evenly overall. And it works quite well. It really is quite a powerful tool. So we can see on this density negative, we had all kinds of problems creating this terrible soundtrack. And Martin, if you are ready, we could play number one.
That's Helen Harding.
Helen Harding?
Good lovely.
Helen.
So we hear all this terrible noisy modulation in the soundtrack. After using that processing, Martin, if you could play number two, please.
That's Helen Harding.
Helen Harding?
Good lovely.
Helen.
So we can see it smooths out the track overall. It's still a very rough track. That was one of the most difficult restorations we had, and sadly, only a sound element available on this motion picture. So it's one of those cases you have to do what you have to do with what you have. So these are, again, some examples of some of the soundtrack captures we caught. And I know you really have been waiting to hear what this stuff sounds like. So I'm going to shut up, and we'll let Martin play number three.
On the 22nd of September, October I should say, 1921, I first heard that wonderful achievement of Sven Berglund of the talking film.
So that's kind of what we put together as a little sampler that we called the Best of Berglund, or for short, it was called Bob. Well, we talked with the archive about how they wanted to process this. We were able to send them samples, of course, electronically. And we came on a pretty much a hands-off process to just basically try to even out the noise floors a little bit, but not take away any of the energized noise of the recording starting up. And so this is the preservation processing for this track. And if you play number four, please.
On the 22nd of September, October I should say, 1921, I first heard that wonderful achievement of Sven Berglund of the talking film.
So, you know, we heard there was some counting, a little bit of music recording, somebody blowing a whistle, and then, of course, somebody actually got close to the horn and started to record some dialogue that we could understand. But I think it's pretty interesting. I mean, his statement that he could record record sound on a motion picture piece of film is absolutely accurate. Now, just for fun, and because, you know, really the question is, so how good was the recording? Was, of course, we have a lot of technical horsepower available to us, and though we did not apply it for the project for the Swedish Film Institute, I thought you might find it fun to see, so if we could help uncover some of the limitations in Berglund's recording, how good really could this recording sound to an audience today? So you're going to get to hear something. As you can hear, we're very lucky, even though it starts off mislaid, something recorded October 29th, 1921, and I call this little demonstration Peeling the Onion. So we're going to start out with the raw recording, and every beep you're going to hear a little bit of different processing added. We're going to add some filtration to help improve it. When we add the noise demodulation at first, you're going to hear the noise floor increase, and then you'll hear a beep and it decreases, till we really kind of uncover the full recording, and then at the very end, you go back to what the original recording sounded like. So, Martin, if we could play number 5, please.
No. Three.
The first word sent over the telegraph by Morse from Baltimore to Washington was, "What hath God wrought?" On the 22nd of September, October, I should say, 1921, I first heard that wonderful achievement of Sven Berglund of the talking film in Brevik, near Stockholm. Today, on the 29th of October, it is with great pleasure that I appear again to hear and to speak before it. I will utter only a few words of which will be familiar to everyone. The Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us.
So, you know, really, there's a pretty good recording hiding in all of that noise floor, which is always what amazes me about the capture of optical recording technology. So these are the things that we delivered to the Swedish Film Institute. There's an optical soundtrack negative that they'll use to print with all of the images that are on the film. So people actually see these soundtracks as they hear what the sound of these soundtracks are for the full 10 minutes of film. And then, as they say, digital copies of all of the preservation transfers that we made so that they have some material to, if they want to work with this in the future. Again, I'm always supported by a great group of people at Chase and, of course, the studios who allow us to share our great material with you. And we'll come back to this at the end of the presentations. Thank you.
Thank you.